and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the seventh mass shooting in the United States in just the last 7 days, with 10 killed in a supermarket in Boulder, Colorado on Monday by a 21-year-old with an assault rifle, Ahmad Al-Aliwi Elisa, a resident of Boulder who shops at the supermarket, which was the scene of yesterday's massacre. Aya Gruber, professor of law at the University of Colorado School of Law, who writes in the areas of criminal law and procedure, comparative and international law, critical theory and feminism, and is the author of The Feminist War on Crime, The Unexpected Role of Women's Liberation in Mass Incarceration, joins us. We'll discuss the shock and unease in Boulder, which is in a state that has already experienced the Columbine School Massacre, the shooting at Planned Parenthood of Colorado Springs, the Aurora Theater Massacre, and the STEM school shooting in Highlands Ranch. Then we'll speak with Saul Cornell, chair in American history at Fordham University and the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect?, and his latest, The Second Amendment Goes to Court. We'll discuss how the NRA just celebrated a victory in having a Colorado state court strike down a Boulder City ordinance that banned assault rifles like the one used in the latest massacre. Then finally, we'll look into the Biden administration's opening salvos in diplomacy between superpowers, with Biden calling Putin a killer and Blinken getting into a shouting match with China's foreign minister, as well as threatening sanctions against a key NATO ally, Germany. Graham Fuller, a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University, joins us to discuss his article at Responsible Statecraft, Hell Hath No Fury Like a Superpower in Decline. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Aya Gruber, who's a professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School, where she teaches and writes in areas of criminal law and procedure, comparative and international law, critical theory, and feminism. She has written widely on rape law, the feminist critique of provocation and self-defense, domestic violence reform, and on prostitution and human trafficking. And her latest book is The Feminist War on Crime, The Unexpected Role of Women's Liberation in Mass Incarceration. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aya Gruber.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And you're there in Boulder, Colorado. What is the mood in the city? I mean, how are you familiar with the supermarket at which the shooting took place?
Yes, that's my grocery store. It's just a few miles, maybe like a mile from my house. And my husband was actually there yesterday and a few days before getting supplies for my daughter's 10th birthday. So this shooting hits so close to home.
Well, what's extraordinary, though, Aya, is that this is not the first shooting just in this 1 week. It's been an extraordinary number of mass shootings in the United States. Starting on Tuesday in Atlanta, Georgia, 8 people, including 6 Asian women, were killed. And then on Wednesday in Stockton, California, 5 people were shot. Then on Thursday in Gresham, Oregon, 4 people were shot. And on Saturday in Houston, 5 people were shot. And on Saturday in Dallas, 8 people were shot. And on Saturday in Philadelphia, 1 person was killed and 5 were shot. And then, of course, yesterday you had the tragedy of 10 people being killed in Boulder. So What's the latest on your understanding of who the assailant is? We've got a list of the victims, and that's just heartbreaking. But what do you make of who the shooter is? Is there any clarity on that yet?
Well, they've released the name of the shooter, and he was apparently from Arvada, where he grew up and went to high school. He was born in Syria. So as a child, he came to Colorado and basically grew up and went to school in Arvada. And that's all I know. I think that's all they've released so far. One connection that is interesting to the, you know, interesting and also horrific, but one connection to the Atlanta shootings is, you know, this was apparently a lone gunman and another 21-year-old man who, you know, had access in this case to an assault rifle and in the Atlanta case to a handgun, who himself went on a shooting rampage, a young man who by all accounts, you know, went to high school, was had friends, you know, had Facebook posts, and he went on a shooting rampage with the guns available to him.
And of course, all we know so far is he's 21 years old, and he's named Ahmad Aliwi Alisa of Arvada, which is, as you mentioned, it is near Denver. But what I find extraordinary and rather chilling, Aya Gruber, is that just last week, the National Rifle Association celebrated the fact that an assault weapons ban in Boulder, Colorado, was struck down by a state court. Colorado State Judge Andrew Hartman struck down this city ordinance, which had banned the possession of assault weapons and large capacity magazines after the shooting in Parkland, Florida. And of course, it's worth noting here that Colorado has a horrific history of shootings. Columbine High School, Planned Parenthood in Colorado Springs, the Aurora Theater, and the STEM school in Highlands Ranch. But apparently, in terms of what the assault weapons ban that was in place in Boulder, which presumably would have prevented this character, or maybe prevented him from getting an AR-15 assault rifle, was all done by a local right-wing activist, John Caldera. And of course, he is celebrating the ruling. And as I say, just only a few days ago, the NRA posted a celebratory comment about it. Is that something that's a local political issue? It's surely bound to be mentioned now, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's interesting because that had been, you know, being covered in the local press for the last few days that Judge Hartman had overturned Boulder's local assault weapons ban on the ground of, you know, a sort of state versus local jurisdiction issue. So the argument that the judge made was, well, this is a matter of Colorado state law, and we can't have a patchwork of municipalities making their own laws. Of course, the municipalities say, well, you know, we represent the will of our local community, and the will of our local community is pretty clear. That our local community doesn't want assault weapons, these sort of weapons of war in the community. You know, that is, you know, more of a technical question of which sovereign, the local or the state, has jurisdiction, but it's taken on new and pressing meaning in the wake of these horrific events. And interestingly, just today, the Senate in Colorado had already had a hearing scheduled on assault weapons. And so it just so happened that that's going on now, and it was pre-scheduled. So we'll see if there's some movement on the state level, but that's a lot harder because on the state level, you have more of a range of views on assault weapons than on the local level. All that being said, you know, this was a person from Arvada. This is not a person from Boulder. So even if the, you know, weapons ban hadn't been overturned, fine, you can't, you know, technically under the ordinance, the local ordinance, have an assault weapon in Boulder, but you could certainly just bring the assault weapon you're allowed to have in Arvada to Boulder. So this is something that I think we need local, state, and national responses to. We need thoughtful gun policy. It is true that the vast majority of gun owners are law-abiding citizens, and they're not going to use their, you know, guns for bad purposes, and probably they're going to be safe with their guns. But the thought that saturating the world with guns is going to have no effect is just wrong. People who have studied this issue for decades, and I'm thinking, for example, of Frank Zimmering at UC Berkeley, have shown clearly that guns have quote-unquote instrumentality effects. In other words, they affect human decision-making by their very existence in somebody's life, whether you're depressed, whether you're angry, how you're interpreting the internet, whether that ends up leading to tragic violence, either by suicide or homicide, is affected by the presence of guns in someone's life. So it's simply not empirically true to say that guns don't kill, people kill. This is a complex interactive effect. And if people want to live in a society where we have a right to the weapons of war and the instrumentalities of death, and we don't have a right to healthcare and education, the very least they can do is understand the empirical evidence on the risks that guns pose instead of burying their heads in the sand and believing that this is all a matter of people and not weapons.
And again, I'm speaking with.
Sorry, I got a little heated there. So sorry.
Well, understandably, this is your hometown. This is the supermarket that you and your husband shop in. And your husband was just shopping there, what, the day before this happened?
Yeah, he was there the day before and a couple days before that, because we were sort of preparing for my daughter's 10th birthday, and he was returning some items that he had gotten there. So yeah, we are there all the time. And, you know, it's not just us in Boulder. It's that everybody should feel safe that when they go to their local stores, they don't have to worry about a random attack from somebody who, you know, you could name the range of issues that a 21-year-old could have that's going through a pandemic time. And, you know, the thought that in this country, as opposed to so many other countries, we have these incidents of mass shooting that can happen at any time. I mean, that feels to many people like living in a terrorism state, right? Because the whole idea is that, fine, these are rare incidences, but they're so unpredictable and they happen to random people and they have the effect of keeping people afraid. And, you know, there are things we can do about it. There are definitely things we can do to prevent this. I don't think you can completely stop, you know, random killings. They're going to happen sometimes, you know, especially in a country with 300 million people, they're going to happen. But there are things you can do to at least knock the United States off of the pinnacle, right, of being the country with the distinction, the ignoble distinction of having the most mass shooting incidents. There are things, sensible things we can do. So I think that's the frustration. The frustration isn't that like we're all at any moment going to be killed. That's just not true. And people shouldn't live with that fear. It is that it's so random and it's so upsetting to people. And there are things we can do about it. That we're not doing, and I think that causes the frustration.
And again, I'm speaking with Aya Gruber, who's a professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School, who teaches and writes in the areas of criminal law and procedure, comparative and international law, critical theory, and feminism. She has written widely on rape law, the feminist critique of provocation and self-defense, domestic violence reform, and on prostitution and human trafficking. And her latest book is The Feminist War on Crime, The Unexpected Role of Women's Liberation in Mass Incarceration. Well, in response to the, as I mentioned, the NRA was celebrating the overturning of the local ordinance in Boulder, Colorado, banning assault rifles. And this guy, John Caldera, apparently was violating it with carrying around, open carrying his AR-15, the very same weapon that this shooter used yesterday to kill 10 people, including a very popular, apparently, Boulder, Colorado policeman, father of 7 kids, I might add. So the NRA tweeted out today in response to this massacre in Boulder, Colorado, the text of the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, the citizens' rights to bear arms shall not be infringed. Well, let's just take the first part of that ayah. A well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. Well, we are neither secure or free if we can't go to a supermarket, if we can't go to a mall, if we can't go to a movie theater without being shot. I mean, why can't we use the Second Amendment against these people like the NRA?
So it's really interesting because until 2008 in the famous case, District of Columbia versus Heller, the Supreme Court had generally interpreted the Second Amendment to be the right of states, right, to have well-regulated militia and not the right of individuals to have as many high-capacity weapons as they wanted. So that's, you know, relatively in the history of the United States, a recent interpretation of the Second Amendment that has a very particular politic behind it, including the NRA. And I'll say this, you know, again, the vast majority of gun owners are law-abiding citizens. You know, things aren't going to happen. They're not going to go out and shoot a grocery store. And there are a lot of people who really do feel strongly about this right in ways that, you know, just as a person who doesn't have those political leanings, you know, I don't understand, but, you know, other people do. Like, other people do understand that as part of their identity, right? Their gun ownership, and maybe even more than other rights that I would say, you know, are more important to a well-functioning society, like education, healthcare, the right to a decent wage, minimum wages, and things like that. But, you know, other people feel that their identity and their sense of being in the world is tied to gun ownership. And that has to be taken into account. But on the other hand, you know, it doesn't have to be as much guns as you want at any time with no regulation, right? We don't have that for anything. You have to get licensed to drive a car. I mean, there are many sort of dangerous instrumentalities that, because we live in a society where we are interconnected, we understand that there have to be some regulations in order for us to not have to, like, live in fear of going to the grocery store. So I don't think it's necessarily an either or proposition. And again, I think it's just a matter of, okay, people want to own their guns. They feel like it's a matter of identity. I mean, frankly, it's more dangerous to gun owners themselves to own guns than to other people. For example, the risk of getting depressed and then committing suicide with your own gun, you've increased your risk for that. But, you know, if people want to do it, that's, you know, that's part of the discussion. But what kind of upsets me is it's almost like it takes over and then nothing matters anymore, right? And we've seen this phenomenon in many areas, but, like, facts don't matter anymore. The danger to themselves and others don't matter anymore. And they're, you know, and you just live in this world of alternative facts where just having an arsenal of guns is somehow not dangerous. No, it is dangerous. Now, maybe you still want it anyway, but understand the risk to yourselves and others. And also then we also get into the situation where the gun right becomes such an important cultural issue that people's sense of compassion and interconnectedness and empathy with other people gets distorted. So, for example, if you react to the Sandy Hook killings or these horrific killings in Atlanta and Boulder, and your first thought is, I better go buy some more guns because they're going to be regulated soon. If that's the first instinct you have, I mean, something is off with the moral compass, right? That is not sort of a reaction we might expect to a tragedy, right? We might expect stopping and thinking and reflecting and then maybe deciding you want guns anyway. But if it's an instinctive thing that tragedy means buying more guns, like that's the first thing you think about, then I think the ethos and the, you know, authoritarian power of the gun movement has completely taken over people's moral compass. That, I mean, I'm not saying this is a black and white issue. You know, people care about what they care about, and there's a significant portion of this country that gun ownership is incredibly meaningful to. And that's real. That's their feelings. But at the same time, in, you know, elevating this as a cultural and political issue, we can't lose our basic humanity.
So just in the last couple of minutes, I agree with President Biden today at a press conference said, I urge my colleagues in the House and Senate to act. We can ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines in the country again. And then he mentioned these bills. The United States Senate, and I hope some of them are listening, should immediately pass the bills that close loopholes in the background check system. These are bills that receive votes from both Republicans and Democrats in the House. So you mentioned that there was even in the Colorado state legislature, they were talking about a ban. What do you think the chances are of a national ban? You, of course, we all recall what happened after Sandy Hook and the massacre of those young children at school. Obama thought he could get an assault weapons ban through, and he failed, and he was actually in tears. He was so frustrated, and of course, his vice president at the time was Joe Biden. Do you think the mood has changed in this country, Aya?
It's really hard to say. And let me just clarify, in the Colorado legislature, I'm not, you know, I'm sure that a ban will probably come up, but I think the hearing is just on, you know, assault weapons and sensible gun regulation. So I'm not sure that a ban is even something that's necessarily in the works there, but just some ways of looking at the issue. And I think one of the problems is that, you know, one of the sort of pro-gun measures that was adopted by Congress several years back that was lobbied for by the NRA was, you know, the government ceasing to collect public health data on gun violence. And you know, that is just outrageous, right? We need to know about the problem. If it's not a big problem, right? And one might say, well, these are horrible events, but they're rare enough that they're not a problem. Well, we need to know. We need to know what the problem is, how often this is, how to prevent it, what are the sensible measures. But if we can't even study it because the emotions are so strong and the identities are so strongly linked to gun ownership or being anti-gun, that's, you know, that's going to really thwart debate on this. So the first thing is I think we need to study the problem. And then the second thing I just want to use this second of time to say for listeners is I don't think we have to live in fear. I don't think we have to live in fear of going to grocery stores. These are horrific and awful events, and they hit close to home. And I'm, you know, feeling obviously emotional about it because this is my community. But, you know, our chances of dying in a mass shooting event are low, and I don't think we have to live in fear. The frustrating part is there are things we can do, sensible things we can do right now that the vast majority of Americans agree with. And I even think that they could be things that gun owners say, okay, like, I think that's sensible too. But when we have this rhetoric that you're, you know, you're not really a Republican or you're not really pro-gun rights unless you, you know, sort of push everything out to the side. And then, you know, you could say on the other side, you know, take a very, very extreme view of like no guns ever, 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 right? Like, but if you take this view of, you can't even talk about it. You can't even talk about sensible regulation. I think the frustration is we're not even doing the minimal that needs to be done to start addressing these completely preventable, horrific tragedies. And I'm hoping, you know, people have said the fact that we couldn't pass sensible gun control legislation after the children died, 6-year-olds. Right, that the slaughter of 6-year-olds means we're never going to do it. I hope that's not true. I hope that there is a moment of reflection where people can say, this is enough.
Well, Aya Gruber, I thank you so much for joining us here today, and you have our condolences for the pain in your community, and I hope it heals soon.
Yeah, and my heart goes out to the victims of these shootings and the Atlanta shootings. It's something I don't want to have to imagine. It's unfathomable what they're feeling right now. So my condolences to the families.
And again, I've been speaking with Aya Gruber, who's a professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School, who teaches and writes in the areas of criminal law and procedure, comparative international law, critical theory, and feminism. She's written widely on rape law, the feminist critique of provocation and self-defense, domestic violence reform, and on prostitution and human trafficking. And her latest book is The Feminist War on Crime, The Unexpected Role of Women's Liberation in Mass Incarceration. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing how the NRA just celebrated a victory in having a Colorado state court strike down a Boulder City ordinance that banned assault rifles like the one used in the latest massacre.
But it won't be long, 'cause kids with guns, easy does it, they've got something to say.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Saul Cornell, who's the Paul and Diane Gunter Chair in American History at Fordham University and the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect? And his latest book is The Second Amendment Goes to Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Saul Cornell.
Thank you for having me.
And I understand, Saul, you've been involved with this case in Boulder, Colorado, which just only recently the NRA was celebrating the fact that they got a Colorado state court to strike down this Boulder City ordinance that banned assault rifles like the very AR-15 that was used by this shooter in the massacre yesterday. So tell us about that case.
So, Ian, one of the amazingly complicated things about American gun laws, and indeed it's a puzzling thing to people outside the American system, at least as far as almost every aspect of the law is concerned, is this complicated patchwork where we have federal law, state law, and then local ordinances. Now, once upon a time, if you go back into early American history, there was just a pretty broad recognition that states and localities, and that order, of course, include places like Boulder, had something called police power. And the police power was the power to enact laws that were necessary for public safety and public welfare. And even calling it a power, you know, power of government, in some ways obscures the fact that really it's America's true first freedom. It's the right of the people to regulate their own affairs. It's really the first grievance in the Declaration of Independence, that Americans demand a right to representation and they demand a right to be able to pass laws for their own public welfare. So essentially what the NRA and other gun rights groups have done very successfully, I might add, over the last several decades is to strip away as much of the power of individual localities to exercise that police power when it comes to guns. Colorado actually is a state, like California, I might add, where there's a tradition of home rule. And large cities are supposed to retain a good deal of their authority to pass these kind of laws. So the case in Colorado was really about this tradition of home rule and this right of state preemption. It actually had very little to do with the issues that normally define this debate, which is to say the right to keep and bear arms.
Well, as it happened, of course, the NRA today, in response to the massacre at the supermarket in Boulder yesterday, tweeted out the text of the Second Amendment. The state shall have a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. The citizen's right to bear arms shall not be infringed. Well, what about the first part of it? I know under the Heller decision, Justice Scalia turned the whole thing on its head, and it's been a disaster ever since. But the intention of the Founding Fathers is a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. Well, why can't we make an argument out of the obvious, which is we're not secure and we're not free? That is the context.
Well, I think you raise an interesting point, which is if we're going to honor the Second Amendment, why do we tend to focus on only part of it and not try and read it holistically? And as you pointed out, one of the really interesting is one way of describing it, I suppose, aspects of that case was Justice Scalia decided to read the Second Amendment backwards. He actually set aside the preamble, which comes first, considered what he thought the rest of the amendment meant, and then went back to make sure that that interpretation could be reconciled with the first part. Justice Stevens, of course, pointed out that no other provision of the Constitution has ever been read backwards. I suppose if the Constitution had been written in Arabic or Hebrew, you might have gone from the other side of the page, but our Constitution is written in English, so you would have thought we would follow the normal procedure. So you're quite right that the idea that you would have so little effective regulation of firearms so that someone like this individual could walk into a gun store and 15 or 20 minutes later walk out with a very deadly weapon without having demonstrated any capacity to use it, without having been properly trained in gun safety, and really without anyone else in the community knowing he had done this, that is just quite hard to reconcile with the realities of the world that gave us the Second Amendment, where people lived in small, mostly rural communities, where everyone was connected by ties of family and community and kin. And the whole idea of anonymously buying a weapon just would not have been possible in the 18th century, because you would need to have a pretty good relationship with your local gunsmith if you wanted to keep your musket or your fowling piece in good working order.
So what then, just going up to the present, after these massacres, there's usually a political effort to bring about gun control. And of course, Obama failed and was brought to tears over his inability, in spite of the massive amount of public support, the overwhelming amount of public support after the Sandy Hook massacre of these young six-year-old kids. He still couldn't get anything passed because of the grip that the NRA had over the Congress. Now, their grip slipped a little bit because they've been so damn corrupt and outrageous, and all their dirty laundry's come out, and they've been a bunch of hustlers as opposed to great exemplars of American freedom and standing up for the Constitution, as they like to portray themselves, just money-grubbing characters who were only too happy to launder a bunch of Russian money in the 2016 election. So what do you think Biden's chances are now, since today he's called for the Senate to take up the House bill that deals with background checks and gun show loopholes?
Well, what we've seen since Sandy Hook, and perhaps even more significantly since Parkland, are a couple of different things in the gun debate. So for the first time in the modern era, the forces favoring more regulation have resources that were unavailable to them for much of the last few decades. So we now have a much better organized, a much better funded, and a much more disciplined movement focused on gun safety. And there have been a lot of victories, but they have tended to be victories in places where we already have sensible gun laws. So essentially, since Sandy Hook, what we've seen is an almost tectonic plate shift, with pro-gun states doing away with what few gun laws existed, and pro-regulation states enacting more gun laws. So we really are two different countries when it comes to that. And when you get to the federal level, of course, we've had dysfunctional government at the national level on almost every issue for quite a long time. Obviously, unless some reform to the filibuster is achieved, we won't get any new gun legislation either. But perhaps if we actually go back to the filibuster of the past, where we make senators hold the floor, like Jimmy Stewart and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, maybe if we actually make it a little bit more difficult for them and force them to be a little bit more principled rather than simply politically opportunistic, perhaps we can get some modest regulation at the federal level. But of course, the other thing to point out is even the measures that we're talking about at the federal level would still make America's gun laws the weakest in the industrial West. And to really make progress on this issue, I think we have to get to the root of the multiple problems about guns. It's not one issue. It's really three issues. It's the problem of alienated white men, usually, or alienated men, at least, who are involved in these mass shootings. It's the day-to-day toll of gun violence in urban communities. If you're a young African-American male, it's probably safer for you to join the military than it is to stay home in terms of your risk of gun violence. And then, of course, the great killer of adult white men is not interpersonal gun violence, but suicide. And all of those different aspects of our gun violence problem require different solutions and have different dynamics.
Well, just in closing, I imagine from your point of view, Saul, it's even worse than my feelings is that I've seen this bad movie before. This is like a terrible version of Groundhog Day. Do you think that there's a chance in this divided country to come to some consensus? If we can't go to the supermarket, if we can't go to the mall, if we can't go to the movie theater, if our kids can't go to school without the threat of them being shot, then what kind of country are we?
Well, of course, this raises a very profound issue, which is, are the mythologies that defined America and of being a country where one can exercise one's liberty in a way that was unparalleled in human history or in the West, is that ideal really been consigned to the dust heap of history? Because we've now created a situation where something that the founding generation would have called licentiousness, not liberty, where this sort of perverse libertarian vision of freedom and rights has given us a kind of anarchic society where you're right, we can't do the most simple things without fearing for our lives. And that, of course, means we're not free at all. And, you know, what we often forget is that the people who wrote our Constitution feared anarchy as much as they feared tyranny. And we certainly hear a lot about tyranny, but what we need to hear a lot more about is how we've created an anarchic society where you know, how much safer are you than the person who's trying to live their life in Beirut? In some parts of America, maybe not so different than living in Beirut from the point of view of your day-to-day life. So right. That's an issue that I think we need to reckon with as a society.
Right, and we certainly saw a lot of anarchy on January the 6th in Washington, D.C., and I thank you, Saul Cornell, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Saul Cornell, the Paul and Diane Gunter Chair in American History at Fordham University and the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect? And his latest book is The Second Amendment Goes to Court. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the Biden administration's opening salvos in diplomacy between superpowers, with Biden calling Putin a killer, and Blinken getting into a shouting match with China's foreign ministry, as well as threatening sanctions against a key NATO ally, Germany. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. And his latest book is Bear, a novel of eco-violence in the Canadian Northwest. And his latest article at Responsible Statecraft is Hell Hath No Fury, Like a Superpower in Decline. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
So before we discuss your article at Responsible Statecraft, Graham, I was just interviewing the other day Charles Kupchan, who was on the National Security Council in charge of Europe for both Clinton and Obama. And he has an article with Lieutenant General Lute, who was in charge of Afghanistan on Obama's National Security Council. And they're both calling for a U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in spite of all the critiques of what might happen as a result. But one of the things that I pointed out to him was the absolute absurdity of the U.S. military protecting mines in Afghanistan that are owned by the Chinese. And he pointed out, well, that the Chinese have a much more mercantile approach to foreign policy. They do business deals with countries, not just Afghanistan, but in Africa. And we seem to be always sending our troops first as opposed to our businessmen. Do you think that's a fair critique?
I think it's absolutely a fair critique. This is one of the reasons why China is where it is today, has not been primarily through impressive military growth. Their military growth is significant. It's not as much as the U.S. by any means, but compared to its economic projection of power, the military side is very small. And so it's an opening wedge with other countries which are very willing to deal with China and benefit from these economic things. Ironically, you know, I think both Russia and China are happy to watch the U.S. sit there in Afghanistan messing things up because China doesn't like the Taliban particularly either. They hate Islamic fundamentalists. Russia similarly hates Islamic fundamentalists. So if we get out of Afghanistan, I think it means that regional powers are going to have to take a far more significant role in trying to bring some stability to Afghanistan. And regional powers include Russia, which borders, or as it used to, the former Soviet Union, Russia, China, India, Pakistan, and Iran. All these countries have stakes, bigger stakes than we do there. And I don't see why we shouldn't let the regional powers worry about how to bring the country, Afghanistan, under some degree of greater stability.
And you used to be the CIA station chief in Kabul, did you not, Graham Fuller?
That's correct, yes. But that was just before the Soviet invasion. So I did not live through, personally on the ground, the period of Soviet occupation, which, of course, was a disaster for the Russians, as it was 100 years earlier, been a disaster for the British. But I guess nobody reads history anymore.
So turning to your article at Responsible Statecraft, it doesn't sound like the best diplomacy to call the leader of a superpower a killer and a man without a soul. And when you have pretty brittle relations between the United States and China, to have a screaming match in the first meeting between the new administration's foreign policy team, Secretary of State, and the China experts, along with China's head of foreign affairs, who I suppose might have started the shouting match by indulging in what Xi Jinping has urged his diplomats to engage in, known as wolf warrior diplomacy. But after, as your article points out, after 4 years of Trump, one would have thought things might be a little more sort of nuanced and professional, but how does it strike you, Graham?
Well, you know, I've spent a lot of years working on geopolitics and been in CIA and doing a lot of these other things. I maybe am naive, but I would sort of think that when you're having trouble with a major power like China or Russia, for that matter, that you might go in initially somewhat gingerly seeking points of accommodation where you can find them as soon as possible. So I'm not sure what the mentality, the rationale is on the part of the administration in going in with guns blazing, whether this is to satisfy American public opinion or Congress that Biden is going to hang tough, that we're not going to be pushed around, whether he really believes it. It's very, very hard to say, but it would not seemingly be the best way to start off to find common ground with two major world powers.
Well, just to quote Jack Matlock, who was Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the then Soviet Union, he just wrote last month, "The United States will not be able to deal successfully with the most important challenges facing it unless it can work in tandem with other large countries to manage threats that are global in nature, nuclear weapons, pandemics, global warming, and the more destructive technology if used in warfare." The same, of course, can be said of Russia. So I have to add here, Graham, that the Biden administration is now threatening Germany with sanctions over the completion of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. So the Biden administration is not only getting tough with Russia and China, but also getting tough with the U.S.'s most important NATO ally.
Yes, it's astonishing how many enemies the administration feels it can take on at any one time. And I really wonder what is behind this. I mean, that's part of the theme of the article, but is it simply that the U.S. is, well, I don't think there's any doubt in my mind that the U.S. is in relative decline in power in the world, but is it the desperate belief that we have to restore that triumphalist, that supreme power that has always marked the U.S. military's approach to things, that it has to be, I forget the term they used, but I think it was called all azimuth
full spectrum dominance.
That's right, full spectrum dominance. That may have been somewhat true maybe 10, 15 years ago, but I mean, that today seems to be a very foolish approach and not a way to work a new world order in which more and more countries are able to disagree with us and go their own way.
So do you think it's possible that the U.S. could stumble into a new Cold War and arms race with China?
Yes, I think it's very possible. It depends on how much emphasis the United States is going to put on the military side. But even if we limit it to a military side, I think the Chinese are proving, I hate to say it, it's painful, but the Chinese are proving far more adept at working with other countries, approaching them on issues of common interest. So that diplomatically, I think we're losing the game as well. And militarily will not make up for it. I mean, it's appalling to think, but China seems to be the more rational party these days, the party that wants to have more peaceful coexistence. They talk about win-win solutions. I don't want to have to believe everything that China says, but I think they're talking a better game than we are virtually with the whole world right now.
And again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He's lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. And his latest book is Bear, a novel of eco-violence in the Canadian Northwest. And he has an article at Responsible Statecraft, Hell Hath No Fury Like a Superpower in Decline. So,
Ian, I should just mention that I also served 4 years in Hong Kong as a CIA officer. That was my last overseas tour. And I've studied a lot of Chinese. So I'm somewhat comfortable with the East Asian scene apart from just the Middle East.
Well, but Hong Kong's democracy has all but been quashed, has it not?
Yes, it certainly, it's not perhaps exactly like the conditions in the mainland, but there's no doubt. I mean, I don't know why there is huge surprise about this, because when the island was turned back over, the British turned the island back over to China by treaty in, I think it was 1997, I don't think it took too much imagination to wonder how long it would be before China would begin to try to impose some degree of greater control over Hong Kong. It should be pointed out, by the way, that it was not a democracy under the UK, under UK rule. It was run fairly tightly by the UK. So the transition to China was nothing new. And I fear that if it hadn't been for some fairly radical Chinese young people's movement for Hong Kong's independence, I don't think China, Xi Jinping, would have come down on them quite as hard and quite as soon as he did. But there's never been any discussion of Hong Kong independence. It's always been the British viewed it as part of China. So I think many Hong Kong residents feel that these young radicals that were perhaps received diplomatic support, moral support from the United States last year, including moving into violence, simply pushed China over the line to crack down faster and harder than it need have been.
Yeah, well, that's a kind of replay of what happened at Tiananmen, I guess.
Yes, except that went on longer, and there was no doubt that Tiananmen was sort of, you know, in the heartland of the capital, whereas...
Right. Well, I'm not excusing the Chinese government's crushing of democracy. And I mean, what they clearly did, though, was to get rid of democratic aspirations amongst the young Chinese. They encouraged nationalism and materialism. But as your article points out, you cannot deny the success of this government, however repressive it might be, because it's lifted 500 million people out of poverty into the middle class. You now have Chinese tourists running around the world. It's an amazing story of success. And I think amongst all the China bashing, we at least should recognize that.
That's true. And also I noticed that the term totalitarian sometimes creeps into American reference in referring to China. But this is not by any stretch of the imagination. And I don't want to speak here in defense of China, but I think we need to be clear in our own thinking. China is not a totalitarian state. The Soviet Union was. The press in the Soviet Union presented a wildly ideological view of the external world. The Russians couldn't read anything outside, coming in from outside of the country. They were not allowed outside of Russia. You know, as you say, Ian, we've got hundreds of thousands of Chinese traveling the world, reading what they want, talking with anybody they want. But they have to remember when they get back home that there are red lines about essentially Communist Party control of major foreign policy. And when we say Communist Party, we're talking about 90 million people as members of that party who have some voice and input into what China is doing.
So turning back to Russia, as I mentioned, Jack Matlock, former ambassador, is calling on a summit between these two leaders, Putin and Biden. Do you think that's in the cards? Because aren't these sanctions, a new round of sanctions against Russia, about to be announced?
There are. I haven't followed the very latest iteration of sanctions, but I mean, I think anything that is going to discourage broad contact is going to have very negative repercussions on our diplomatic relations. It might sound corny, But, you know, I mean, I think everybody knows that contact and exchange with other people is one way to start to begin to solve certain kinds of problems at the human level. And I for one, people may call me naive, but I, for one, think that if Putin could come to, you know, could come to Maryland and have a barbecue over the weekend, and these guys could sit around and eat barbecue and drink beer or have the equivalent in some dacha in Moscow, this would go a long way to beginning to talk out some of these problems. But nobody's willing to talk to anybody, and it's just descending into almost childish rhetoric that will solve nothing.
Well, it is a shaky situation, that's for sure. So I'm just curious to know whether or not the priority, though, should be both in terms of Russia and in terms of the United States of getting their own house in order. I know the young people in Russia are very disillusioned with the Putin kleptocracy, and they're being cracked down on pretty ruthlessly. And Navalny, of course, is in prison. And in this country, we seem to have massive domestic problems. One is that there's no consensus in this country about what is true and what is real. So I don't know how in hell you can solve a problem unless you agree what the problem is in the first place. And then you've got the recent attack on the Capitol itself and these divisions, which, by the way, Trump will exacerbate and continue to exacerbate because he's essentially controls the Republican Party and controls the primary process. Therefore, you're going to have more and more sort of QAnon-type Trumpsters being elected to the United States Congress. So I think we've got some major problems in this country that's divided over what is real and what is true, and is, of course, is divided bitterly over its politics.
I agree absolutely, and it's quite tragic because I don't know how the U.S. is going to be able to recover from such a situation. But above all, I think it should, I mean, I think the average American would probably agree that now is not the time to go off speaking in holier-than-thou terms and preaching to China, especially to China, which has been very successful in so many ways, or even to Russia until, as you say, we get our own house in order. But I think I don't see, the point is, you know, I don't see why there has to be confrontation in all these areas. You can say, well, you know, the U.S. is a great power and Russia is a great power and China is a great power, so there's got to be clashes. It doesn't have to be that way. Leaders choose to have confrontations. Of course, rivalry, that's part of the world. But leaders choose to either be enemies or not enemies. I mean, we've seen, you know, the British and the French were enemies against Napoleon for 100 years. The German and the British were enemies for hundreds of years. The French and the Germans were. I mean, you could talk about the fact that the French and Germans are destined to be enemies through till eternity. But the fact is, right today, under a brand new system, leaders have decided, no, we don't need to be enemies. So I think we need to get out of this rut that somehow challenge from other countries and their power automatically means that we have to be in a collision course. That's really simple-minded geopolitics.
Well, Graham Fuller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure as always, Ian. Thank you. Look forward to talking again sometime.
Absolutely. And again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He's lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. And his latest book is Bear, a novel of eco-violence in the Canadian Northwest. And his latest article at Responsible Statecraft is Hell Hath No Fury, Like a Superpower in Decline. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down.